Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Alexandra Ortolia-Baird, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Giulia Bonazza about her new book, Abolitionism and the Persistence of Slavery in Italian States, 1750 to 1850, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2018. Giulia, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Hello, everyone.
Thanks so much for being with us today. So let's just jump in straight with our kind of first question, which is always, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the topic of the book?
Yes, sure. Currently, I am postdoctoral fellow in an international project named Documenting Africans in Transatlantic Slavery. In Paris, in CNRS. And I came to the topic of the book during my PhD. I did my PhD in Ca' Foscari University of Venice. It was a joint PhD program with the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. And I started to study Mediterranean slavery and in particular slavery in Italian state. And for me was something new because during my master thesis in University of Bologna, I did a thesis on Haitian Revolution, and so I studied more before the Atlantic slavery and the Atlantic colonial world. So during my PhD, I moved from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, even if in my book the Atlantic is still present because there are many slaves in Italy that came from the Atlantic and not only from North Africa or the Ottoman Empire, as we can imagine.
Thanks, Giulia. That's a very kind of clear trajectory. Can you just briefly, you've kind of already introduced some of those points, but highlight to us what your motivations were really in writing this book?
Yes. So I think this book is important and innovative because it really shows the persistence of slavery in at the end of 18th century and in 19th century. So in a chronological period in which we think that slavery is only a colonial phenomenon, in reality we have slaves in Europe and in particular also in Italian state. So I think this book is important. This was an important motivation, and not only for historian, but I think for all the citizen, not only Italian citizen, but in general for all the people of the world, is important to know that there were many slaves also in Europe. that probably is a neglected phenomenon, in particular for the Italian case.
Thank you. I mean, we're going to definitely, I think, come back to that point a little bit later in the interview. But before we do so, could you just briefly outline the general structure of the book for the listeners and perhaps the main arguments or takeaway points that you want readers to come away with?
Yes. The book is divided in 5 chapters. In reality, the first chapter and the last chapter are the introduction and the conclusion. So the 3 important chapters are chapter 2, 3, and 4. They're really the main core of the book. Because the 3 main aspects of this book are the reverberation of the abolitionist debate in Italian state. So this chapter 2 is really on abolitionism. At the beginning, I trace the abolitionist discourse and legal abolitionism in general in Europe. After, I focus more on the Italian state, and I present many juridical abolitionist law in each of the state that I took in consideration. And after, I trace the intellectual movement of abolitionist thinkers in Italian state. Chapter 3 is really my archival research on slaves cases in Italian state. In reality, to be specific, my case studies are 6 cities of Italy. So in particular Palermo, Naples, Caserta, Rome, Livorno and Genoa. And my archival research was based in these cities in which I found slaves cases, that these cases are interested not too much from a quantitative perspective, because there are not many, but they are interested because I was able to reconstruct a little bit the biography, so the origin, if they came from the Atlantic or from a city of North Africa as Algiers or Tunis, and because I was able to understand the living condition, the working condition of these slaves in Italian cities, and I tried to do some comparison between the different cities, and so between the different pre-unitarian state in which these cities was based. Another important chapter is chapter 4, that is a more experimental chapter because it's on the memory of slavery, that it is a difficult topic for Italy and for the Italian state because, as you know, Italy had not in early modern period a colonial empire, a formal colonial empire as Great Britain or France or Spain or the Netherlands, but we had only an empire at the end of the 19th century, so really late. And we think that slavery is not something related to the Italian context for the early modern period, but in reality is not true. And so in this chapter, I try to show that this memory is present because also in Italy we have many statues, for instance in Livorno, the famous statue of the 4 Moors, that show that slaves were present in early modern period also in Italian state. And we have also many portraits, so art history is fundamental sources for this memory of slavery. and also more visible because archival sources are mainly for historians. On the contrary, we have really many portraits in Italy that show that many Italian nobles had slaves also in 19th century. So in this chapter, I show, for instance, also some portrait of Comte as Giuseppe Manara or the Comte Lecchi in Brescia that had slaves. So I think this chapter is quite innovative, and also it's important for our contemporary debate in this day, also on the destruction of statue in the world, so not only in Europe, but this phenomenon starts in the United States. So I think also in Italy this debate is quite important. And the conclusion of the book is a conclusion named Abolitionism and the Continuity of Slavery, because really I show that even if also in Italian state we had the abolitionist law, as in Great Britain, as in France, we have also the persistence of the phenomenon. And in particular, in this conclusion, also the objective is to demonstrate, the book really wants to demonstrate that the Italian abolitionist movement and thinkers really was only against slavery in the colonial world in particular, and the abolitionist in Italy, but I think we can talk more in general of an European phenomenon, really it seems that they don't take in consideration slavery more closely, so in Italian city, but they only made reflection mainly on Atlantic slave trade, on colonial slavery, only sometimes on Mediterranean slavery, but never refer on slaves in Italian cities. So I think for this chronological period, this is something innovative.
And these chapters that you've brought up, especially chapter 4 and the conclusion, are incredibly powerful. And I think, especially today in the current kind of global climate, they really struck me upon reading. And they're very, very important, as you say, contributions, I think, not just to the historical discussion, but also to kind of civic awareness. So just kind of circling back a little bit, because I'm aware that perhaps many listeners are not perhaps familiar with the history of slavery in the Italian peninsula. Yeah. So could you just give us a very broad overview of this history, which leads up to the period that you've studied in the book?
Yes, sure. In Italy, we have an important historiography on captivity in Mediterranean. And also on slavery in Mediterranean. Obviously, all these books are written in Italian and not in English. And so we have the important book of Salvatore Bono, Schiavi, translated in English, Slaves. Also some important books of Giovanna Fiume and many other historians. These books are really important, took in consideration only the phenomenon of captivity in Italy, and often they study only specifically one city, and the period, the chronological period of this Italian historiography was always from the 15th, 16th until the 18th century, and the 19th century was always excluded in his historiography. And so for me, this historiography was a fundamental starting point, also a first article of Raffaella Sarti. She found a case of slaves also in Bologna at the end of the 19th, at the beginning of the 19th century. And so this first article of Raffaella Sarti was important because other historians understand the urgence to find other slave cases in other cities for the first half of the 19th century. And also for the part of the book more on intellectual history, we have an important book of Alessandro Ticillo, always written in Italian, on the anti-slavery movement, in particular in Naples, but the book of Alessandro Ticillo focused only specifically on the Enlightenment period, so really on the 18th century, and also Ticillo didn't study the abolitionist thinkers of the 19th century. I think it's important that also other scholars and people interested in this topic read this Italian book, and also my book for this more late period of the end of the 19th century and for the 19th century.
So just staying with this topic that you've kind of brought up of historiography, you draw attention to the shift in scholarship from what you say is the history of slavery to the history of the slave, which you kind of see as a result of methodologies from Italian microhistory and subaltern studies. But you also kind of highlight the lack of data on slavery quantitatively regarding the Italian context. So can you explain to us how your research mediates this tension in its approach, and what kind of source materials have you relied on in order to do that?
Yes, sure. Considering the attention on the slave and not on the general phenomenon of slavery, yes, I think this is a shift is important, and not only for me but for a new generation of scholars, because before also for the Mediterranean the objective were more to present this phenomenon of ransom of captives, if we think also at the French book of Wolfgang Kaiser, Le Commerce des Captifs. So it was more on quantitative data, and also to understand the phenomenon of the ransom. And concerning quantitative data, the problem is not only for the Italian case, but is more in general a problem for the studies on Mediterranean slavery. Because we have some estimation of the presence of slaves in nearly modern period in Mediterranean, made by Salvatore Bono or Aurelia Martin Casares in Spain, and the number is around 6 million, 7 million. So compared to the Atlantic trade that we have around 11 million, 12 million, the number is totally different, but these numbers are really not precise because for the Mediterranean slavery, we have not, as for the colonial slavery, this important register of the state, because for instance, for the French colonial empire, if we want to study slavery in the French colonial empire, in Paris and in the next in Provence, we have these archives of Outremer, and we can find many complete lists of the number of the slaves. for the Mediterranean is more complicated because we have to find these traces, but we have not really a complete list of the number of slaves. So we have to find slaves in many types of different sources. And for instance, I use sources as baptism register, so Catholic sources, this important archival group of house of catechumens in Rome, family archives, sources as soldiers and galleys in state archive, but also juridical sources. So I really used a wide range of different type of sources to try to reconstruct this this life of the slaves, considering the methodology. Yes, I was for sure influenced by the Italian microhistory and the subaltern studies, but in reality I didn't use Italian microhistory because it's some really more complex and you have to use a particular type of exceptional sources that I do not use because I collect different type of sources. But for sure, in this book, for me, it's really important the connection between the local, these local cities and the global, because we discovered that we have slaves that come from different parts of the world, also from Brazil, also the French colonial empire. So we really discovered that the global and the local are really connected, and that the attention on the history of slave because is important because we can discover how they change their identity also with after the baptism they change their name. So also it's fundamental try to reconstruct the origin, the movement, the circulation and the entering in this new community in Italian cities. So I think, I use more in general an approach of social history.
So you've raised two really kind of interesting kind of terms or concepts, which are captivity and ransom. In your answer there. And I wanted to speak kind of more generally about this kind of really core issue of terminology and language when talking about slavery in historical context. So could you perhaps outline some of the difficulties that you faced with regards to the language being used in this period to describe the forms of enslavement and the varied terms and meanings that you actually encountered?
Yes. In general, in historiography, we find in book the word slaves and captives. And the difference between the two words is that a captive is a slave, but only for a short period of time. So is a captivity is a temporary form of slavery. On the contrary, the condition of a slave is a permanent condition because a slave cannot be ransomed by his family or by the state as a captive. So it's a different condition. The problem is that even if in historiography we use these two words in sources, the taxonomy, the vocabulary is more complicated because for my case studies, I really don't find in sources the word captive, but I find the word slaves, for instance, only in Catholic sources. But in statal sources, you find word that define more the ethnic origin of a captive or a slave, as Turk or Turkish or black. I found the color of the slave, but in statutory sources I never find really the word slave for this also period of the end of 18th century, first half of the 19th century. So we find also the word Moor, so often the historian have to understand that this is a slaves or captives with the other data of the sources. On the contrary, for the Catholic sources is more easy because in baptism register you really find that this is a slaves, that for instance, he was born on a ship, on a Portuguese ship by an African slave. So we really, in Catholic sources, we really find important data that really prove the presence of Atlantic, also slaves. On the contrary, on statutory sources, I found more Mediterranean captives, but yes, the taxonomy employed is quite different by the word that today historians use when they write books.
And it was really fascinating reading the book to kind of see this really profound difference in vernaculars between the types of sources. But I just want to kind of move ahead a little bit to chapter two, where you discuss the reverberations of the abolitionist debate in the Italian state. So could you just outline for listeners the shape that abolitionism took in the Italian states and perhaps its similarities and differences with other European nations?
Yes. For sure, the Italian abolitionism was deeply influenced by the French abolitionism, but also by the abolitionist movement in Great Britain. Another big difference is that for the Italian case, we have not really important figure that we can say, this was an important abolitionist thinker. Yes, we have Gaetano Filangieri for the 18th century, other important figure that Alessandro Tucillo studies, but for the 19th century, we have a wide range of intellectuals as Andrea Zambelli, but also we discovered his abolitionism more in newspaper. For instance, in the Gazzetta di Milano, so a daily newspaper in Milan, or l'Anthologie of Vissio, it was an important newspaper in Florence. If we read that this newspaper, we found a reflection on the problem of slave trade, of slavery. They try to propose some solution to try to stop the phenomenon. Or in this newspaper, they translate a lot some abolitionist writing of written by the French or the British abolitionist thinker. We have also among the group of quite anonymous abolitionist thinkers in Italian state, Algenore de Gasparina, who wrote Schiavitù e Tratta, so Slavery and Trade. I found also an important academic course for the University of Padova at the half of the 19th century of an economic historian of the period written really to try to find some solution to stop the trade. Also, Catholic newspaper have some abolitionist articles, as the famous Catholic newspaper Civiltà Cattolica, but we have also the Nuovo Giornale dei Letterati. This abolitionism is present in newspaper, in annals, in really short book, or in university course of the first half of the 19th century. But I think this is really a starting point for future research, because probably there are many other unknown abolitionist thinkers in Italian state. So it's something that probably have to be analyzed more in deep. And in particular, Prenitar Italia State, France was an important center. The French abolitionist movement was an important center. But when we read this article on the Italian newspaper, you discover that the Italian tried to enter in this debate on progressive abolition, so the debate on the apprenticeship made by the Gran Vita in his colonial world, or if they are for a more direct abolitionism, as France made in 1848. So we can understand how the Italian thinkers try to enter in this international debate and to propose some solution, but for sure this Italian debate was less important that the abolitionist movement in France, or the abolitionist movement in Great Britain, or also the Quakers movement in the United States. But I think today is really important. The historians started to study abolitionism also in other states, because today we talk about Italy, the Italian case. But also in Germany, there are really new projects also on the abolitionist movement, also in German state before the unification, and also on the topic of slavery in German cities. So I think it's really important that today in Europe we try to study, to discover that this important topic of slavery and abolitionism is also a topic that concerns deeply also the country that had not a formal colonial empire.
And I think that's something that, you know, your book does so well, is to really show the complexity of slavery in the Mediterranean context, and also globally then. But just kind of picking up on the last question, could you perhaps go into a little bit more detail about the actual kind of intellectual history of the Italian abolitionist movement? So especially the kinds of arguments and ideas that were really driving the kind of intellectual debate?
Yes. So in this debate, the role of the Haitian Revolution is really important. For instance, in Andrea Zambelli, Sulla schiavitù dei negri, there is really a reflection on the quality of the black slaves with the white men. And this equality is really proofs, the proofs for these philanthropists was the Haitian Revolution, because for the first time in history, the slaves made an important revolution against the colonizer, the white French colonizer, and they demonstrate his effort and his ability to become independent and also to become free. So this point of the Haitian Revolution is really important in Italian abolitionism. And also there are these intellectuals are also really interested in the economic aspect of the profitability or not profitability of slave trade, in sense that as in Great Britain, they think that the trade of slaves the beginning of the 19th century is not something profitable from an economic point of view. So really many reflections are also related to the economy of the time. And for sure, the concept of equality, of the terrible condition of slaves started to become more and more important. And also the Papal State in the 19th century, so the Pope started to write important document, important encyclical that are fundamental also for the king of each European country against the terrible phenomenon of slave trade and of slavery in the colonial world. So also this role of the Papal State in the world really was fundamental, because if we think ad in Supremo Apostolatus in 1939 of Gregorio VI, this was a really important act of abolitionism against trade and colonial slavery. But also at the end of the century, if we think of the International Conference of Bruxelles, the important encyclical of Leon XIII, the Pope Leon XIII, in plurimis, was a really abolitionist important document. I think there are many specificity on this intellectual but also political abolitionist movement in Italian state.
Thank you, Julia. That's very kind of helpful to kind of frame it in kind of the different elements of discussion. So in chapter three, you move on to kind of talk about the forms of slavery in the Italian states. And something that I thought was particularly striking was regarding the baptism of slaves in cities like Naples and Rome. Could you give us a little bit of a background to the demographics and the nature of these baptisms that took place?
Yes. So for the case of Naples, the baptism was fundamental because often was in Naples imposed, because I find slaves there of nobles, men, or of traders. So we found the original name of the slave, for instance, in 1925, there is Pasquale, was born on a Portuguese ship, and his origin was Guinea. And something interesting is the Pasquale, after the baptism, changed his name, and the family name who is adopted is Marino Caffiero, the same Caffiero, the same family name of the owner. So the new Italian name of Pasquale is Salvatore Maria Raffaele Francesco Marino Caffiero. So he's really changed his identity. So this is one of the first aspects, really, really important. But we are able to understand, yes, the origin. Often he was his mom. For instance, in his baptism register is written was an African slave. So we have some data. Concerning Rome, also it depends, because if they are captives that work in galleys for the papal state, often the baptism is not imposed, but is more a request of the slaves, that they prefer to be baptized because they don't want to live or to stay in galleys all the time, because the working condition was terrible. So they prefer to be baptized, because in Rome, if they want to receive the baptism, they have to live for 1 year in this house of catechumens. And in this year, they don't work, but they are only educated at the Catholic religion. And after the baptism, they can improve their social and working condition, because in many cases, slaves in Rome after the baptism became soldiers in Castel Sant'Angelo. So really there is an improvement of their living and working condition. But also in Rome, after the baptism, they don't have the juridical freedom, the legal freedom. So we can say that they have a really, really better condition, but they are not free. And sometimes they can also receive a form of salary or remuneration. This both in Rome, but also I found many slaves, they are paid in Caserta. So also these cases show the complexity, the tension between the legal and juridical status and the working and social condition in this community. For sure, the baptism is something that really tried to cancel the past of this man, because they changed name and they tried to be assimilated in this new Christian community.
Thank you. It's such a fascinating kind of dimension of the book, and religion just more generally is really central, I think, to your narrative. But I think the connections between different faiths and slavery is perhaps more complex and diverse than listeners might be aware of in the Mediterranean. And you give really fascinating accounts of different types of slavery. So that of Jews, of Turks, of Black Africans, Algerians, Christian Tuscans, Armenians, and many others. And so I'd be interested to hear more about how religion was a motivating factor in Italian slavery, and also the extent to which it was conflated with ideas of race. And you touched a little bit about this earlier when talking about the different ways and the different vocabularies used to describe slavery. But maybe you could speak a bit more about the connections between race and religion.
Yes. So in reality, in my book cannot prove that black slaves had a more terrible living condition than other type of slaves, as captives from the Ottoman Empire or Jewish slaves. But for sure, in sources, this connotation of blacks is important, because also in Catholic sources, written often in Latin, we find this expression Turca Nigra. So also if we have not a slave from the Atlantic world, but for instance a captive from North Africa who is black, this is really specified in sources. And so this is an important element concerning the taxonomy. another element that prove not that black slaves have a worse living condition in Italy, but the proof they have an inferior economic value, because I found some economic sources of ransom of slaves that proves that, for instance, in Algiers, they don't want black slaves that came, for instance, from Palermo or Livorno, but they want only Levantine captives or Algerian captives, because these sources prove that in this exchange, when also Italian city tried to ransom some Christian slaves, for the Italian city is really difficult to try to exchange black slaves. It's quite impossible, because in North Africa they don't want these black Atlantic slaves often. And so it is also an element that for sure prove this phenomenon of racialization, but it seems more motivated by economic reason, because probably in North Africa they prefer to have captives, and as I have previously said, slaves from the Atlantic have not a family or state that can pay for them, so often they stay in Italy and they work for noble families on in agriculture, and they stay there. They not move more in other country.
Thanks, Julia. So I'd like to turn now to chapter 4, which I think is probably for many listeners a really pertinent an important chapter. And here you turn to the memory of slavery and how the history of the West and of slavery are inseparable. And obviously, given the current political circumstances, this has, you know, huge resonance. And you make a really convincing argument regarding the business of the memory of slavery. Could you explain what you mean by this?
Yes. So I think also today there is this complex debate on the problem of memory. As we know, the real problem in Western country is that we have not a shared memory, but in Europe the official discourse is still Eurocentric. We don't want to include other memory of minority groups or of descent of slaves in this official discourse of the state. But my point of the business of memory of slavery is more related to the opening of this museum also in Africa, that have to try to remember the past of the slave trade. And I think the role of this museum, from one hand, could be positive also in Italy, because it's important to have this museum on the history of slavery, because a more wider public can enter in the museum and also learn about this past. But in my sense, also about this opening up of many museums in Africa, it seems that they are also for rich tourists, and so it really don't touch the important point of a shared memory of slavery in Western country, because this memory have to pass by teaching course in school, in primary school, in secondary school, in university. And the strange thing is that in Europe, in particular in each high school in Italy, in Spain, in France, in Great Britain, we have still quite a nationalistic and Eurocentric version of history. And so it seems that it seems that this history of slavery is something still today really not taken in consideration. So the role of museum also in Great Britain, in France, is really important. But yes, so, sometimes I feel the real job have to be made really in school program for this shared memory of slavery, or for this new writing of history of slavery. Because, for instance, in this chapter, I present also some problems of this museum, because for in Nantes, in France, the museum is really a museum on the memory of slavery only in Nantes, okay, with some connection with the problem in general. But also in Great Britain, in Bristol, this museum is really related only to the trader in Bristol. And for instance, there is nothing about Mediterranean slavery. I think there is a lot of job to do about the reconstruction of a new memory of slavery and a new knowledge of our slaves' past.
And I think, you know, you do this so well, and it's an incredibly powerful chapter. And you know, as an intellectual historian, I'm really grateful for when historians like yourself are kind of forcing those on the academic side of history to really think about the resonance that our work has for society and the ways in which we can go beyond this, you know, performative allyship and this kind of performative decolonization of history and of society. And one thing that I think, you know, is possibly really important in this, and that you draw attention to in this chapter, is the emphasis on visual culture and memory. Could you explain how you, the image of slavery in Italy changed, and what this tells us about shifting perceptions of race?
Yes, because now that some art historian or historian started to present this status or this portrait, we start to have an attention also in the public opinion, in newspapers started to write, thanks to Hijab Ashego, also something about this slavery past in Italy. But really, before, even if in Venice, in Livorno also, we have street name called De Turco, really until 10 years ago, we had no perception about his slave's past, but it was really a neglected phenomenon. And so I think really also this interdisciplinary collaboration between historian, art historian, architect is important to reconstruct this slavery past in Italy.
So in your conclusion, you state that, and I'm just going to kind of read a quotation. Despite the affirmation of the great principles of abolitionism in Italian states, forms of slavery survived there for an extended period. The juridical abolitions of slavery in these states were usually imposed and influenced by external powers, namely Great Britain and France. Rather than being the result of internal reflection, these changes were closely connected with evolving international juridical norms regarding the abolitions of the various slave trades. Now, can you just kind of contextualize this a little bit and explain these contradictions between Italian views regarding colonial slavery and the persistence of slavery in the Italian territory? And I know you've touched on this a little bit already, but because something that's so important in your book is this idea of the persistence of slavery. So could you just reveal a little bit more about what you meant here?
Yes. So from a juridical point of view, also in Italy we have abolitionist law against slave trade and slavery, in particular in the Lombardo-Veneto in 1816, in the Kingdom of Naples, we have some law in 1808, in Tuscany in 1853. But I would say that even if we had this abolitionist law and also this intellectual abolitionism, these cases persist. And in particular, the juridical law, the legal law, were more influenced by the external and not by the internal reflection, because as probably you know, from a geopolitical point of view, the Italian state in this chronological period, the end of 18th century, the first half of 19th century, with really important geopolitical base, for in particular for Great Britain and France, they tried to have the monopoly of the Mediterranean in this period. So I think that Italy play a role of intermediary. And in this sense, I said also that these juridical legal law are more influenced by the external, or sometimes imposed, as during the Congress of Vienna or during some bilateral diplomatic agreement between, for instance, Great Britain and the Grand Duchy of Tuscany.
Thank you so much, Julia. To finish, I just want to circle back to your arguments regarding memory and memorialization of slavery. And I'm going to read another quotation just because I think it's really so important for communicating, you know, what your views are in this book. So you say a dialectical relationship based on exclusion from or inclusion in the public mind exists between memory and identity. An attempt to analyze memory as a political act means analyzing not only the public uses and manipulation of memory, but also the sidelining of certain elements of the past and the silences that pertain around controversial issues. All of these dynamics are relevant to how slavery is remembered. There is no public historical memory of the Atlantic slave trade in Italy, even though Italian states were home to slave ship owners and Italian cities were logistical bases for the trade. Now, given the current debates regarding public history and memorialization, I'd like to just finish with, you know, your thoughts concerning the civic and political role of the historian, and also how historians like yourself might contribute to the public historical memory of the slave trade in Italy specifically.
Yes, I think historians have to contribute by writing books. Yes, I think also they have to be engaged in the society. I think also we have to understand that we cannot go more further to study slavery only related to a single empire. So I think today it makes not more sense that Great Britain study only the British Empire, or France the French Empire, because we understand that in slave trade and slavery many actors were implicated and many actors of different nationalities. So it is true that the state of the power, was probably Great Britain or Spain, that they paid the Italian traders, but for sure also the Italian traders or traders of different nationalities were implicated. So I think we have started to study these slaves lobbies of the past. And so this panorama is more complex than the nationalized empire that we have always studied until now.
Thank you, Julia. And before we leave you, because we've taken up so much of your time, could you just give us a quick idea of what you're currently working on?
Yes, so in October I started a new important research project granted by a Marie Curie Global Fellowship, so it's an important European funding, and I will study 2 years in Columbia University in New York and 1 year in Ca' Foscari University of Venice, and my new project is on the value of skin color of slaves and black laborers in the Atlantic and Mediterranean in the period 1750-1880.
Well, we very much look forward to hearing about that research in the future. Giulia Bonazza, thank you so very much for being with us today and talking about your book, Abolitionism and the Persistence of Slavery in Italian States, 1750 to 1850. Thank you again.
Thank you, Alexandra. Thank you, many thanks.